Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Uncle Tom's Cabin may well be the most influential novel in American history, not only at the time it was published 150 years ago for its indictment of slavery, but ever since. That's the subject of this week's interview with Joan Hedrick. Following the interview, we will hear from author Jane Smiley, who wrote the introduction to the recent modern library edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin. But first, let's take a look at an important event that occurred this week in history. On February 25, 1836, Samuel Colt patented his most famous invention, the Colt revolver. Although a remarkable piece of weaponry in its day, the revolver did not initially capture the public's imagination. Deemed too complicated and delicate for use in the U.S. military, and scarcely needed outside of fighting on the frontier, Colt's repeating pistol did not gain immediate widespread attention. In fact, the arms company filed for bankruptcy in 1842. However, demand for the revolver grew. When the Texas Rangers found Colt revolvers essential in their battles with the Mexican army and gave it their high praise, the pistol became a legend. And when American soldiers and civilians began to use it on the frontier, orders poured in, forcing Colt to apply the newly developed technique of mass production and system of interchangeable parts recently devised by Eli Whitney. A master of publicity as well, Colt promoted the image of the self-made man as befitting the American spirit and incorporated his revolvers, also serving as a symbol of frontier justice into that image. Turning to items of historical interest in the news, recently revealed secret documents detail the 1941 meeting of the leader of the Nazi atomic bomb program, Werner Heisenberg, and physicist Niels Bohr, who later became part of the Manhattan Project. The documents refute the long-held notion that Heisenberg had moral qualms about building the atomic bomb for Hitler and that he may have sabotaged the project. The newly released documents suggest, instead, that Heisenberg never intended to sabotage the project and that his intent during his meeting with Bohr was to find out what he knew about the American effort to build the bomb. After examining two previously classified U.S. telegrams from November 1941, intercepted by Japanese intelligence, Japanese law professor Toshihiro Minohara has offered a new interpretation of why Japan attacked Pearl Harbor. Minohara suggests that when the United States abruptly changed its policy from accommodation to inflexibility in regard to allowing continued Japanese aggression in China and Southeast Asia, even anti-war members of the Japanese government became convinced that war with the United States was inevitable and that a preemptive strike at Pearl Harbor was necessary. This is Talking History.
Swing low.
Swing.
Here at Beecher Stowe published Uncle Tom's Cabin in weekly installments in the National Era, an abolitionist newspaper. It was so successful it soon appeared as a novel and took the country by storm. Readers either gave it high praise for its revealing the awful conditions of the nation's peculiar institution, as slavery was called at the time, or condemned it for inflaming the nation and pushing it toward civil war. Talking History's Fred Nielsen explores the history of Uncle Tom's Cabin this week with his guest, Joan Hedrick.
Uncle Tom's Cabin was published in March 1852, 150 years ago next month. It was an instant success and became one of the best-selling books of the 19th century. In a famous jest, Abraham Lincoln greeted the author, Harriet Beecher Stowe, as the little woman who wrote the book that started the Civil War. The war is long over, but a century and a half after the book's publication, Uncle Tom is still with us, still troubling us, still dividing us. With me to discuss Uncle Tom's Cabin and its author is Joan Hedrick, a professor of history and women's studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. Her 1994 biography, Harriet Beecher Stowe, A Life, received the Pulitzer Prize. Professor Hedrick, welcome.
Thank you.
Uncle Tom's Cabin was Harriet Beecher Stowe's angry response to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. What was it about that law that so enraged her?
Well, that law really brought slavery home to the North. Before that time, they could say that slavery was the South's peculiar institution. They didn't like it, but what could they do about it? Now they were liable to fines and imprisonment if they aided a fugitive slave who came to their door asking for help escaping to Canada. So they had to make choices, It really brought it home to them.
We know that the book sold hundreds of thousands of copies after publication. Who were its readers primarily?
Uncle Tom's Cabin was read in the parlor, in the kitchen. It was read from high society down to the servants who were reading it or listening to people reading it in the parlors. It was very broadly read.
You say that when Stowe entered the national debate on slavery, she did so with women's weapons. What were those weapons, and how did they differ from men's?
One of the things that really infuriated Stowe was how cool people could be in the face of human suffering, how passively they could accept the situation and say they couldn't do anything about it. So she knew that people's hearts were better than their heads, and she took aim for their hearts and really knew how to pull on their heartstrings. And she also used the family and issues of family separation very heavily in Uncle Tom's Cabin, and knew that that would be a way to move her white readers, many of whom had, as she had, lost children. So in these ways, she really mobilized a maternal sentiment, a parental sentiment, and in going after people's feelings, she was engaging in what the 19th century thought of as a woman's weapon.
She is, as you say, a woman who has lost a child herself and is writing in part to the mothers of America. And yet you also note in your book that there are some risks in this. You say that the risk that a woman author took in identifying herself with the cause of slavery was considerable, that Stowe placed her own womanhood on the line. Either her reputation would be blasted or she'd transform the meaning of womanhood. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, slavery was a very risky topic for a variety of reasons, and one of the risks for a white middle-class woman was in talking about the sexual abuse that went on a plantation. One of the Southern critics said that she seemed to know more about that subject than many men lounging about bar rooms. So in that way, her own womanhood was impugned by her daring to speak out on sexual issues. Victorian women weren't supposed to even know about such matters, let alone speak publicly about them. So she did take an enormous risk. It was a calculated risk. It was also one I think she felt she just had to take. She felt so pressed by her own emotions and her own sense of urgency on this issue that she just had to speak out. As she said, a woman, a mother, a wife, a sister.
Her sister, Catherine Beecher, was a woman who wrote frequently on the role of women in the 19th century. What was Harriet's view of women's place in the 19th century?
Harriet was much more radical on women's issues than her sister, although she was solidly in the mainstream in that she believed that home was where women had their power. That's where they were. But she really held the country accountable to a moral standard that enabled women operating from that base in the home to have a kind of purchase on public issues that I think people who promulgated the notion of woman's sphere in 19th century never envisioned. In other words, women were using the home as a kind of power base to say, well, if we're expected to be moral, if we're expected to be in charge of the family, if we're expected to be Christian, then what are we to say about unchristian laws that result in family breakups? So she used the home as a kind of lever to really take on a very radical prophetic voice, whereas her sister Catherine was not so drawn to challenging the status quo.
We generally think of Uncle Tom's Cabin as an anti-slavery book, which of course it is, and yet it's filled with examples of women doing exactly what you've described. I'm thinking of an exchange early in the book between a senator and his wife, the Byrds. He's the public man, the man of male power, and yet she almost seems to kind of wield a moral superiority over him.
Mm-hmm. And she calls him to account for standing on the floor of the Senate and in a sublime and abstract voice talking about how important it is to chase down these fugitives when he had never calculated, Stowe says, what it would mean to look into the face of a runaway slave who came to his door and to turn that person away. He hadn't really calculated that the power of human suffering. And his wife was much more responsive on this issue. And you're right that she does take a kind of moral high ground. And the chapter is very nicely entitled, in which it is shown that a senator is but a man. She is continually taking the public role and insisting that people square that with their private emotions and the reality of their private lives.
Was Stowe willing to accept the political subordination of women in the 19th century?
You don't see her speaking out on that issue directly, except toward the end of the 1860s. She does read John Stuart Mill's On the Subjection of Women and makes some very strong statements about suffrage, about that being something that women should have. But by and large, she did not speak out politically on women's issues. She spoke out on behalf of others, which is a less radical stance in some ways than speaking out for yourself, and it has its own perils too when you speak for others.
She hadn't been to the Deep South when she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin. Where did she draw her material about slavery, and how realistic was that portrayal?
Yeah, she had been to a plantation only once for 3 days in Kentucky. She drew most of her material from, it was a combination of written sources like Theodore Weld's Slavery as It Is, which drew on accounts of slave owners, which surely would be reliable sources in terms of not exaggerating the brutalities of slavery, and also on oral tradition. She had in her employ, as many middle-class women did, a variety of servants, some of whom were former slaves, who told stories of their experiences on plantations in Virginia and other places. When she was living in Cincinnati, it was discovered that one of her servants was indeed a runaway slave, and she and her husband Calvin helped her to escape. So she had direct access to people who had the experience of slavery.
Uncle Tom is an epithet now, yet Stowe obviously intended Tom to be an admirable figure in her book. How did she understand him, and how would her readers have understood his character?
She understood him to be a very Christian and altruistic person who engaged in the Christ-like gesture of letting himself be sold so that other slaves on the plantation would not have to be sold. She does engage in a kind of what has been called romantic racialism, where she does make him, in some people's eyes, more noble, less human in that sense, than a character who might rebel, run away, have moral flaws. So she's been criticized for making him better than life in some sense. At the same time, she was able to point to a variety of sources that she drew on in which characters like Uncle Tom appeared. At the same time, she also changed her sources as it suited her. She needed a martyr. She needed Uncle Tom for the story she was telling because she wanted to leave her readers uncomfortable. She didn't want to leave them with a resolution that they were happy about. And for that, it was a kind of national epic that demanded a martyr.
There are some differences among the slaves themselves. George Harris, a character in the book, is of mixed race, and he seems much more quarrelsome than Uncle Tom, who is all black.
Yes, and she's been criticized for that, too, for making her mulatto characters the ones who were the rebellious ones, as if it was the white blood of the Anglo-Saxon that was responsible for that. She apparently modeled George Harris on Frederick Douglass, who was, in fact, part white. There is this racial marking, though, in her book. She believed in generalizing about races, as many people in the 19th century did. She generalizes about the Anglo-Saxon, too, in that book. So the racial thinking, the representation of the African-American is not as progressive as the culture has moved since then.
This is a book written to end slavery, to get rid of it in America, but in the end of the book, it also seems to get rid of African-Americans. Stowe advocates the colonization of Africans back to Africa, and that's where George Harris, in fact, goes. What are we to make, and what did 19th century Americans make of that plea for colonization as the end of slavery?
Well, that has to be read in historical context. When the colonization movement was active in the 1820s, it was a very conservative movement designed to fix slavery by just simply sending the Africans back to Africa and not having to deal with any of the racial issues that that might ensue by freeing them on this soil. It's possible that in the 1850s that was a more nationalistic thought than earlier. George Harris really, in the book, talks about not having a country, that the rules of this country really don't allow him to be a man, and he wants to go to Africa so he has a country. So for a black man to choose to go to Africa is very different from white Protestant ministers deciding that they will send the slaves back to Africa. So I think it has a more nationalistic and politically strong message than it might have earlier. At the same time, I don't think Stowe, she had really thought this out in terms of the politics of the abolition movement. She hadn't been a member of an abolitionist society. She really fell into writing this book out of a combination of her outrage at the fugitive slave law and her own experience in losing a child. So she had a lot to learn, and she did learn, I think, from the reaction that people had to the ending of her story.
Uncle Tom's Cabin had a second life on stage and film into the 20th century. How faithful were those productions to the book itself?
Well, Stowe walked out of one in Hartford saying she couldn't understand the plot. They departed radically in many cases from the book that Stowe wrote. She had no control over those. International copyright didn't exist, and Uncle Tom really became grafted onto the minstrel tradition in the stage versions, where the characters are very stereotyped, and the shuffling Sambo image of Uncle Tom that persisted into the 20th century was strongly shaped by the stage versions, which ran continuously for 90 years. So after people might have stopped reading the book, the stage productions were going on.
There's a kind of literary or cultural debate these days, some people lining up behind Uncle Tom's Cabin, others lining up behind Huck Finn as a great American novel of the 19th century. Coincidentally, Stowe and Mark Twain, Samuel Clemens, were neighbors in Hartford after the Civil War. What do we know of their relationship and their view of the other's work?
Well, they had a very cordial neighborly relationship. Their houses back onto one another on Forest Street in Hartford, and you can visit both of their houses. They're both open to the public, and they visited one another, and Stowe knew Twain's wife. She had a brother in Elmira, which is the town that Olivia Langdon came from, Elmira, New York. Thomas Beecher was there. So there were good connections between the two families, and I think there was mutual respect.
Stowe's world is gone now. The world in which and for which she wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin is a relic of the 19th century. Slavery is long abolished. Our attitudes of race are no longer those that Stowe held. The place of women has been transformed. Given the fact that the world of Uncle Tom's Cabin is so long gone, what place does the book have for us in the 21st century?
It still has a very powerful appeal to readers. It has a very vivid plot and strongly marked characters and a wonderful narrative voice that makes it seem as if Stowe is speaking right to us. Besides that, it really is our national epic. It's about the feudal institution that almost caused the breakup of this country. So I think of it as having an extremely central role in American literary history.
Well, Professor Hedrick, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Joan Hedrick, the author of Harriet Beecher Stowe, A Life.
Through the years I keep on trying, according to the storm and rain. Watchfully and patiently.
American novelist and short story writer Jane Smiley wrote the introduction to the modern library edition of Uncle Tom's Cabin. She joins us this week to offer her perspective on the novel.
Uncle Tom's Cabin is not only a compelling, readable, wise, and well-constructed novel, it is also the most important literary document of the 19th century. It has been almost too hot to handle since the day it was published and remains hot today. Uncomfortable, hard to teach, controversial for whites, blacks, men, women, liberals, conservatives, northerners, southerners, religious believers, non-believers, academics, and non-academics. It refuses to lie down and become a historical artifact, but continues to intrigue, offend, and demand partisanship on the part of every reader. There is no other novel quite like it. While experts differ on exact figures, sales in volume form were comparable to 5 to 10 million copies today, in addition to sales of the serialized version to millions more. And it soon made history. Mrs. Stowe's novel served to educate a whole population. Her philosophic insight was simple and to us natural. Slaves were fully human, capable of thought, feeling, and commitment. But what might have been a sterile exercise was transformed by Stowe's passion, insight, and literary skill into a panorama of the American interior filled with all sorts of voices and opinions about all sorts of subjects, including slavery, politics, spiritual life and religion, economics, marriage and family life, revolution, psychology, the group dynamics of oppression, and the American landscape, not to mention the characteristic ideas and modes of speech of a large cross-section of Americans. Subsequently, the novel came under a critical cloud. Stowe's overt religion and her occasional expostulatory interpolations were considered unsophisticated, while her interest in domestic arrangements was considered trivial and her view of slavery racist. The rise of civil rights and black power resulted in the denigration of Tom, Cassie, smart, sexually experienced, and angry, disappeared from the cultural map entirely. Stowe once called herself a little bit of a woman, somewhat more than 40, about as thin and dry as a pinch of snuff. But she was exceptionally effective at bearing witness. She had information, courage, talent, and humanity. In spite of 150 years of corruption and controversy, Uncle Tom's Cabin still speaks well for itself.
You've been listening to writer Jane Smiley, author of 1,000 Acres, which won both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award in 1992. This is Talking History.
Brother blood, we have the same spirit, of the same mud, brother blood. We're from the same water, from the same blood.
Brother blood,
brother blood,
brother blood.
For our site of the week, we turn to the house where Harriet Beecher Stowe lived when she witnessed slavery firsthand and was inspired to write Uncle Tom's Cabin. Here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Harriet Beecher Stowe really did sleep here. It's the house where she lived and got her inspiration for her book, Uncle Tom's Cabin. The house, located in Cincinnati, was built in 1833 by Lane Seminary for Beecher's father, who was the president of that institution. The house is operated as a cultural and educational center promoting black history. But if you can't get there, you can visit the Harriet Beecher Stowe Center in Hartford, Connecticut. Here, Beecher Stowe lived before moving to Cincinnati. It was established by her grandniece, and included in the Stowe Center Library are personal correspondence, diaries, first editions of works of Harriet Beecher Stowe, and the Uncle Tom's Cabin collection. Both places offer insight into the times of Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Looking ahead to upcoming events of historical interest, we ask, is the camera a reliable witness, something on which we can depend for a true rendering of the past? Probably not, most historians agree, unless the viewer is very careful in examining the record of that which is pictured and the purpose of the photographer. From time to time, museums host exhibits which provide us the opportunity to explore this interesting issue, the most recent being Hidden Truths, Bloody Sunday 1972, now open at the International Center of Photography in New York City. Just who caused the tragic events of January 30, 1972, when an outburst of political violence erupted in Londonderry, Northern Ireland? British police or Catholic protesters? Hidden Truths is an accumulation of forensic materials pertinent to the case. It includes what appears at first to be a no-nonsense narrative or sequence of pictures that appeared in the Sunday Times in London. When matched to the written records of the event, however, serious questions are raised as to their accuracy. Indeed, as one critic put it, the exhibit shows, once again, how pictures, even photographs, can turn the objects from a tragedy into icons, distorting reality. Judge for yourself at Hidden Truths, Bloody Sunday 1972, open now through March 17th at the Center for Photography in New York City. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you'll join us next week when we begin our month-long series on the American Civil War. We invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History, Creighton University, Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Talking History is a production of Creighton University and the Organization of American Historians. To learn more about Creighton, visit the university's website at creighton.edu. Information on the Organization of American Historians is available at oah.org. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian Lebeau.
There'll be no more weeping and wailing.
Oh, Lord, there'll be no more weeping and wailing. Oh, Lord, there'll be no more weeping and wailing.
Oh, Lord, no
weeping and wailing.
I'm going
home to live with God, my Lord. I soon will be done with the trouble of this world, with the trouble of this world.
Oh, Lord, the
trouble of this great God, I soon will be done with the trouble of this world.
I'm going
home to live with God, my Lord.
I soon
will be done with the trouble of this world.
Done with the trouble
of this world.
Oh, Lord, the
trouble of this great God, I soon will be done with the trouble of this world.
I'm going home
to live with God, my Lord. I'm going out to meet my mother. Shake her loving hand,
and I'm going to
tell her about my troubled
heart. Oh,
traveling through this land, my
Lord,
soon we'll be done with the trouble of this world.
Done with the
trouble of this world.
Oh, Lord, the
trouble of this great God, I soon will be done with the trouble of this world.
I'm going home.